Chapter 30. One More Stop. The Dungeon. Resolute. Impossible Stars. The Dark Well. Gog Magog. The Bite. 1. We followed a trail of dead and wounded rats to the hole in the wainscoting. Eris actually helped one three-legged bruiser get inside, then grimaced and wiped her hands on her shirt, which couldn't have done much good, covered in dirt and blood as it was. We came to the door giving on the spiral stairs, which I guessed might be some sort of emergency exit for the royalty in case of fire. I tapped Leah on the shoulder. "One more stop before we go after Flight Killer," I said. "On the level of Deep Malene and the torture chamber, will you do that?" She made no protest, only gave a weary nod. There was still a curd of bloody foam on her cheek. I reached out to wipe it away, and this time she didn't shrink back. "Thank you. There may be someone there who helped us." She turned away before I could finish. Outside the palace, Woody and Claudia and their followers, by now they might be swelled to the size of a real army, had probably entered the city. If there was a barracks where the remaining night soldiers slept, the Grey Folk could be slaughtering them even now, and hooray for that, but in here, time was fleeting, and there was no magic sundial to turn it back. We went down the staircase, down and down, around and around. None of us spoke. The death of Iota sat on us like a weight. Even Radar felt it. She couldn't stay beside me. The barrel we were descending was too narrow for that. But she walked with her nose touching my calf, ears down and tail drooping. The air got chillier. Water oozed from the lichen growing on stone blocks that had been placed here hundreds of years before. No, I thought, longer than that, thousands, maybe. Then I started to smell something, very faintly.
"High gods,"
Eris said and laughed. There was nothing cheerful about it.
"The wheel turns, and here we are, back where we came from."
We had passed several more doors on our way down, some large, some smaller. Leah stopped at a small one, pointed, then went down several more steps to give me room. I tried the door. It opened. I had to bend almost double to go through. I found myself in another kitchen, this one little more than a closet compared to the one we'd passed on our way in. Here there was only one stove, no oven, and a long, low grill, probably powered by gas, but now out. On it was a row of sausages, burned black. Jaya made a sound between a cough and a retch. I suppose she was thinking of all the meals we'd taken in our cells, especially the ones before playtime and the first round of the fair one. I had read about PTSD, but reading about something and understanding it are very different things. On a shelf beside the grill was a tin cup like those we'd had in our cells, only this one had no hole in the bottom you had to put your finger over. It was filled with sulfur matches like the kind Percy had given me. I grabbed it, and since I had no pockets, I relocated the .45 in the concho belt and poked the cup of matches into the holster. Leah led us to the door, peeked out, then gestured for us to follow, twirling her fingers as before, quickly, quickly. I wondered how much time had passed. It was still daylight, surely, but what would that matter if Bella and Arabella kissed on the other side of the world? I guessed that the Flight Killer was already at the Dark Well, waiting for it to open so he could try to make another bargain with the thing that lived there, either blind to the terrible events that might result or not caring. I thought the latter more likely. Eldin of the Galleon, Eldin the Flight Killer, a flabby, greedy, green-faced goblin waiting to call something from another world into this one, and then, perhaps, into mine. I considered telling Leah to forget about taking us to the torture chamber. Percival, might not even be there, or he might be dead. Surely stopping Flight Killer was more important. Eris touched my shoulder.
"Prince Charlie, are you sure about this? Is it wise?"
No, it wasn't. except without Percival, a man with the gray disease so advanced in him he could barely talk, none of us would be here.
We go,
I said curtly. Eris touched her palm to her forehead and said no more. 2. I recognized the passage where Leah was waiting for us, shifting from foot to foot, clasping and unclasping the hilt of her sword. To the right of the auxiliary kitchen was the way to the dungeon. To the left, and not far, was the torture chamber. I ran, leaving the others behind, except for Radar, who loped beside me, tongue flying from the side of her mouth. It was farther than I remembered. When I reached the open door of the chamber, I paused long enough to think something that wasn't quite a prayer, just, please, please. Then I went in. At first, I thought it was empty. Unless that was, Percival had been enclosed in the Iron Maiden. But if he had been, blood would surely have been oozing out, and there wasn't any. Then, a pile of rags in the far corner stirred. It raised its head, saw me, and tried to smile with what remained of its mouth.
Percy!
I shouted, and ran to him.
Percival!
He struggled to salute me.
Nah, it's I who should salute you. Can you stand?
With my help, he was able to get to his feet. I thought he'd wrapped one of his hands in a dirty piece of the blouse he wore, but when I looked at it more closely, I saw it had been wrapped around his wrist instead and knotted tightly to stop the bleeding. I could see a dark, crusty patch on the stones where he'd been lying. His hand was gone. Some bastard had chopped it off. The others arrived. Jaya and Eris stood in the doorway, but Leah came in. Percival saw her and raised his remaining hand to his brow. He began to cry.
Hinsa!
It was the closest he could get to princess. He tried to bend a leg to her and would have fallen if I hadn't held him up. He was filthy, bloody, and disfigured, but Leah put her arms around his neck and hugged him. I loved her for that, if for nothing else. Can you walk? I asked him. If you take it slow and rest every while, can you? Because we're in a hurry, desperate hurry. He nodded. And can you find the way out? He nodded again.
Jaya,
I said, this is where you part company with us. Percival will guide you out. Walk with him. Let him rest as he needs.
But I want to...
I don't care what you want. This is what I need from you. Take him out of this pit. There will be others by now. There better be, I thought. Get him to Claudia or Woody and get him medical attention. Medical attention isn't what I said, but Jaya nodded. I hugged Percival as Leah had.
Thank you, my friend. If this works out... they should put up a statue of you.
Maybe with butterflies perched on your outstretched arms, I thought, and headed for the door. Leah was already there, waiting. Jaya put an arm around him.
I'll be with you every step, Percy. Only guide me.
Hinch!
Percival said, and I turned back. He made every effort to speak clearly. He pointed to the door.
Four of us. And it. He. It.
Now he pointed at Leah.
He owes a.
Now he pointed upward.
Ella and Ella. Hoon.
I looked at Leah. Did you understand him? She nodded. Her face was dead pale. The sore through which she took nourishment stood out like a birthmark. I turned to Eris. Did you?
Fly killer,
she said.
Four others and the bitch, or maybe it was the witch. Either way, I think he must mean Petra, the cunt with the mole on her face who was next to him in the box. He said the princess knows the way. and something about Bella and Arabella. They kiss soon,
Jaya said, and Percival nodded. Take care of him, Jaya. Get him out of here.
I will, if he really knows the way. And make sure I see you again, all of you.
She bent and gave Radar's head a quick goodbye stroke. 3. Leah led us away from the circular stairway and into a different corridor. She paused at a door, opened it, shook her head, and went on.
Does she really know where she's going?
Eris whispered.
I think so. You hope so. It's been a long time since she was here.
We came to another door. No. Then another. Leah peered into this room and beckoned. It was dark. She pointed to the cup of matches I'd taken from the kitchen. I tried to scratch one on the seat of my pants, a cool trick I'd seen some old-time cowboy do in a TCM movie. When that didn't work, I scraped at a light on the rough stone beside the door and held it up. The room was paneled in wood rather than faced with stone, and filled with clothes, uniforms, cook's whites, overalls, and woolen shirts. A heap of moth-eaten brown dresses lay below a line of wooden dowels. In the corner was a box of white gloves going yellow with age. Leah was already crossing the room, Radar trailing her but looking back at me. I lit another match and followed. Leah stood on her toes, grabbed two of the dowels, and pulled. Nothing happened. She stepped back and pointed at me. I handed the cup of matches to Eris, grabbed the dowels, and yanked. Nothing happened, but I felt some give. I pulled harder, and the entire wall swung outward, bringing with it a gust of ancient air. Hidden hinges squalled. Eris lit another match, and I saw cobwebs, not whole, but hanging in gray tatters. Added to the heap of dresses pulled down from the dowels, the message was clear. Someone had been through this door before us. I lit another match and bent down. In the dust were overlapping tracks. If I'd been a brilliant detective like Sherlock Holmes, I might have been able to deduce how many had gone through this hidden door, maybe even how far ahead of us they were, but I was no Sherlock. I did think they might have been carrying something heavy, based on how the tracks were blurred, as if they'd been shuffling rather than walking. I thought of Flight Killer's fancy palanquin. More steps led down, curving to the left. More tracks in the dust. Far below was dim light, but not from gas jets. It was greenish. I didn't like it much. I liked the voice that whispered from the air in front of me even less.
Your father is dying in his own filth, it said.
Eris drew in a sharp breath.
The voices are back.
Don't listen, I said.
Why don't you tell me not to breathe, Prince Charlie?
Leah beckoned us. We started down the stairs. Radar whined uneasily, and I guessed she might be hearing voices too. 4. Down we went. The green light grew stronger. It was coming from the walls, oozing from the walls. The voices grew stronger too. They were saying unpleasant things, many about my dismal exploits with Birdie Bird. Eris was crying behind me, very softly, and once she murmured,
Won't you stop? I never meant to. Won't you please stop?
I almost wished I could face Hannah or Red Molly again. They had been horrible, but they had substance. You could strike out against them. If Leah heard the voices, she gave no sign. She descended the stairs at a steady pace, back straight, her tied back hair brushing between her shoulder blades. I hated her stubborn refusal to acknowledge that Flight Killer was her brother. Hadn't we heard his cronies shouting his name at the Fair One? But I loved her courage. I loved her. By the time the steps ended, in an arch overgrown with moss and torn cobwebs, we had to be at least 500 feet deeper than Deep Moline, maybe more. The voices faded. What replaced them was a dark humming that seemed to come from either the damp stone walls or from the green light, which was much brighter now. It was a living light, and that humming sound was its voice. We were approaching some great power. And if I had ever doubted the existence of evil as a real force, something separate from that which lived in the hearts and minds of mortal men and women, I didn't now. We were only on the rim of the thing generating that force, but getting closer to it with every step we took. I reached out to touch Leah's shoulder. She jerked, then relaxed when she realized it was just me. Her eyes were wide and dark. Looking into her face, instead of at her resolute back, I realized she was as terrified as we were. Maybe more, because she knew more.
"You came here?" I whispered. "You and Eldon came here as children?"
She nodded. She held out her hand and gripped thin air.
"You held hands?"
She nodded, yes. I could see them, hand in hand, running everywhere. But no, that was wrong. They wouldn't have been running after all. Leah could run, but Eldon had clubbed feet. She would walk with him, even if she wanted to sprint ahead to the next thing, the next surprise, the next secret place, because she loved him.
"Did he have a cane?"
She raised her hand and showed me a V, so two canes. Everywhere together, except for one place.
"Leah was never one for books,"
Woody had said.
"Eldon was the reader of the two."
"He knew about the secret door in the room where the clothes were stored, didn't he? He read about it in the library. Probably he knew about other places, too."
"Yes. Old books. Perhaps forbidden books, like the Necronomicon, the made-up one Lovecraft liked to write about. I could see Eldon poring over just such a book. The ugly boy with the clubbed feet, the boy with lumps on his face and a hump on his back, the one who was forgotten except when there was a cruel practical joke to be played. I knew all about those. Bertie and I had played our share during my dark period. The one who was ignored by everyone except his little sister. Why wouldn't he be ignored when his handsome elder brother would eventually take the throne? And by the time Robert ascended, sickly, limping Eldon, bookworm Eldon, would probably be dead anyway. Such as he didn't live long. They caught a bug, coughed, took fever, and died. Eldon reading the old dusty books, either from high shelves or from a locked cabinet he pried open. Maybe, at first, just looking for power to use against his bullying brother and sharp-tongued sisters. Thoughts of vengeance would come later.
"It wasn't your idea to come here, was it? Other parts of the castle, maybe, but not here."
"Yes."
"You didn't like it here, did you? The secret rooms and the rising platform, they were okay. Fun. But this was bad, and you knew it, didn't you?"
Her eyes were dark and troubled. She made no sign, yes or no, but her eyes were wet.
"Eldon, though, he was fascinated by it, wasn't he?"
Leah only turned and began walking again, making that twirling come on gesture with one hand. Back straight. Resolute. 5. Radar had gone ahead of us a little way, and now she was nosing at something on the floor of the passage. A scrap of green silk. I picked it up, looked at it, tucked it into the holster with the tin cup of matches, thought no more about it. The way was wide and high, more tunnel than passage. We came to a place where it split in three, each bore lit with that pulsating green light. Over each entrance was a keystone carved in the shape of the thing I'd last seen in two pieces on the floor of the residence wing. A squid-like creature, with a nest of tentacles obscuring the horror of its face. The monarchs were a blessing. That thing was a blasphemy. Here's another fairy tale, I thought. One meant for adults instead of children. No big bad wolf, no giant, no Rumpelstiltskin. That's a version of Cthulhu over those arches. And is that what Gog-Magog is? High priest of the elder gods, dreaming his malevolent dreams in the ruins of Ryla? Is that what Eldin wants to ask another favor of? Leah paused, started toward the left-hand passage, stopped, started toward the center passage, and hesitated again. She was looking ahead. I was looking down at the floor, where I could see tracks in the dust going into the right-hand bore. That was the way Flightkiller and his entourage had gone, but I waited to see if she'd remember. She did. She entered the right-hand passage and started walking again. We followed. The smell, the stench, the mephitic odor was worse now. The hum, not louder, but more pervasive. Flabby, misshapen mushrooms, as white as a dead man's fingers, were growing out of the cracks in the walls. They turned to watch us pass. At first, I thought that was my imagination. It wasn't.
"This is terrible,"
Eris said. Her voice was low and desolate.
"I thought Malene was bad. And the field where we had to fight. But they were nothing to this."
And there was nothing to say to that, because she was right. We walked on and on, the way always trending downward. The smell was worse, and the hum got steadily louder. It was no longer just in the walls. I could feel it in the center of my brain, where it seemed not to be a sound, but a black light. I had no idea where we were in the world above, but surely we'd passed beyond the palace grounds, far beyond. The tracks thinned and disappeared. No dust had fallen this far down, and there were no dangling cobwebs. Even the spiders had deserted this godforsaken place. The walls were changing. In places, the stones had been replaced by great, dark green blocks of glass. Within their depths, fat black tendrils swirled and swarmed. One rushed at us, and its headless front folded open, becoming a mouth. Eris gave a weak scream. Radar was now walking so close beside me that my leg brushed her side at every step. We finally emerged in a great vaulted room of dark green glass. The black tendrils were everywhere in the walls, darting in and out of strange carved shapes that changed when you looked at them. They curved and twisted, made shapes, faces.
"Don't look at those things," I told Eris.
I guessed Leah already knew. If she had remembered how to get here, she would surely remember those weird, changing shapes.
"I think they'll hypnotize you."
Leah was standing in the center of this gruesome nave, looking around, bewildered. It was ringed with passages, each pulsing with green light. There had to be at least a dozen of them.
"I don't think I can,"
Eris said. Her voice was a trembling whisper.
"Charlie, I'm sorry, but I don't think I can."
"You don't have to." The sound of my voice was flat and strange. I think because of the humming. It sounded like the voice of the Charlie Reed who'd gone along with every dirty trick the Birdman thought up, and then added some of his own. "Go back, if you can find your way. Stay here and wait for us if you can't." Leah turned a complete circle, doing it slowly and looking at each passage in turn. Then she looked at me, raised her hands, and shook her head. "I don't know." "This is as far as you went, isn't it? Eldin went on from here without you." Yes. But eventually he came back. Yes. I thought of her waiting here in this strange green chamber, with the weird carvings and the black things dancing in the walls. A little girl, holding steady, holding resolute, in spite of that insidious hum. Waiting here, alone. Did you come with him other times? Yes. Then pointed up, which I didn't understand. After that, did he come without you? A long pause. Then, yes. And there came a time when he didn't come back. Yes. You didn't go after him, did you? Maybe this far, but no further. You didn't dare. She covered her face. It was answer enough.
I'm going, Eris blurted. I'm sorry, Charlie, but I can't.
She fled. Radar went after her to the entrance we'd emerged from, and if she'd gone with Eris, I wouldn't have called her back. The hum was invading my bones now. I had a strong premonition that neither Princess Leia nor I were ever going to see the world outside again. Radar returned to me. I knelt and put an arm around her, taking what comfort I could.
You assumed your brother was dead?
Yes. Then she clasped her throat, and guttural words emerged in front of her.
Is dead. Is.
The self I had become, was still becoming, was older and wiser than the high school kid who had emerged in that field of poppies. This Charlie, Prince Charlie, understood that Leia had to believe that. Otherwise, the guilt of not trying to rescue him would have been too great to bear. Yet I think, by then, she knew better. 6. The floor was polished green glass that seemed to go down to endless depths. The black things swarmed beneath us, and there was no way to doubt that they were hungry. No dust here, and not a single track. If they had left any, a member of Flight Killer's coterie had wiped them away just in case someone, us, for instance, tried to follow. With Leia unable to remember, there was no way to tell which of the 12 passages they'd taken. Or maybe there was. I remembered the woman with the beauty mark beside her mouth, shouting, "Kneel, old blood, kneel, old blood." Petra was her name, and she had been wearing a green silk dress. I retrieved the scrap I'd found and held it out to Radar, who sniffed it without much interest. The hum and the black shapes in the glass blocks were affecting her, too. But she was what I had, what we had.
Which one?
I said, and pointed to the tunnels. She didn't move, only looked up at me, and I realized the terrible atmosphere of this place had made me stupid. There were commands she understood, but which one wasn't among them. I held the scrap of dress to her nose again.
Find, Radar, find.
This time she lowered her nose to the floor. One of those black shapes seemed to leap at her, and she danced back. But then she put her nose down again.
My good dog, my brave dog.
She went toward one of the tunnels, backtracked, and went to the next one on the right. Then she turned to me and barked. Leia didn't hesitate. She sprinted into the tunnel. I followed. The green glass floor in this passage tilted down more steeply. If the incline had been even a bit more severe, I think we would have lost our footing. Leia increased her lead. She was fleet of foot. I was the galoot who could only be allowed to play first base.
Leia, wait!
But she didn't. I ran as fast as the inclined floor would allow. Radar, lower to the ground and with four legs instead of two, did better. The hum began to fade, as if somewhere a hand was turning down the volume on a gigantic amplifier. That was a relief. The green glow from the walls also faded. What replaced it was a fainter light that brightened slightly as we came to the mouth of the passage. What I saw there, even after everything I'd experienced, was all but impossible to believe. The mind rebelled against what the eyes reported. The room of many passages had been enormous, but this underground chamber was far bigger. And how could it be a chamber when above me was a night sky littered with pulsing yellowish stars? That was where the light was coming from. This can't be, I thought, then realized that yes, it could. Hadn't I already come out into another world after descending another set of stairs? I had come out in the world of Empis. Now here was a third. More stairs circled a colossal shaft that had been driven into solid rock. Leah was descending them, running full out. At the bottom, 500 or more feet below, I could see the flight killer's palanquin, the gold-threaded purple curtains closed. The four men who had carried it were cringing against the curved wall and looking up at those alien stars. They had to be strong men to have carried Flight Killer all this way, and brave, but from where I stood with radar beside me, they looked small and terrified. In the center of the stone floor was a huge derrick, easily 100 yards high. It was not unlike those I'd seen at construction sites in my hometown, but this one appeared to have been constructed of wood and looked weirdly like a gibbet. The jointed mast and supporting boom formed a perfect triangle. The load hook was attached not to the well cap I'd imagined when I imagined the dark well, but to a gigantic, hinged hatch that pulsed with a sickly green light. Standing near it, in his purple caftan-like robe, the golden crown of the galleons absurdly askew on his straggling white hair, was the Flight Killer.
Leah!
I screamed.
Wait!
She gave no sign that she heard. She might have been as deaf as Claudia. Down this final circle of stairs she ran under the dim light of nightmarish stars shining from another universe. I ran after her, drawing Mr. Bowditch's gun as I went. 7. The men who had carried the palanquin started up the stairs to meet her. She stood with her legs apart in fighting stance and drew her sword. Radar was barking hysterically, either in terror of this awful place I was sure we'd never leave, or because she understood the men were threatening Leah. Maybe both. Flight Killer peered up, and the crown tumbled from his head. He picked it up, but what came from under the purple robe wasn't an arm. I didn't see what it was, or didn't want to, and at that moment I didn't care. I had to get to Leah, if I could, but I already recognized that I wouldn't be in time to save her from Flight Killer's bearers. They were too close. The range was too long for the revolver, and she was in the way. She braced the hilt of the sword against her stomach. I heard the one in the lead shout something. He was waving his arms as he climbed, the other three behind him. I caught, "Nah, nah," but not any of the rest. She didn't have to smite him. In his panic, he ran on her sword without slowing. It went into the hilt and came out on the other side in a spray of blood. He tilted toward the drop. She tried to yank her sword free, but it wouldn't come. Her choice was simple and stark: let go and live, or hold on and follow the man over the side. She let go. The impaled man fell 100 or more feet from where Leah had skewered him, and crashed down not far from the palanquin he'd helped to carry. He might have been promised gold, or women, an estate in the countryside, or all three. What he'd gotten was death. The other three came on. I ran faster, disregarding the very real possibility of stumbling, maybe over my dog, and taking a mortal fall. I saw I was still not going to be in time. They were going to get to her first, and now she had only the dagger to defend herself with. She drew it and put her back to the wall, ready to fight to the death. Only, there was no fight, and no death. Even the man she'd killed probably had no intention of engaging her. "Nah, nah," was what he'd been shouting just before the impalement. These fellows had had enough. All they wanted was to get the hell out. They ran past her without a look.
"Come back!"
Eldon cried.
Come back, you cowards! Your king commands you!
They paid no heed, leaping up the stone steps two and three at a time. I grabbed Radar's collar and pulled her tight against me. The first two palanquin bearers got past us, but the third stumbled against Radar, who'd had enough. She thrust her head forward and chomped deep into his thigh. He waved his arms in an effort to regain his balance, then fell into the shaft, his final diminishing shriek cut short when he struck bottom. I started forward and down again. Leah hadn't moved. She was peering at the grotesque figure in the flapping purple robe, trying to make out his features in the dim light of the stars glowing in that insane abyss over our heads. I had almost reached her when the light began to brighten, but not from the stars. The hum returned, only now it was deeper. Not but the sound of some alien being, colossal and unknowable, scenting a meal it knows will be delicious. I looked up. Leah looked up. Radar looked up. What we saw swimming out of that dark, star-shot sky was terrible. But the real horror was this. It was also beautiful. If my time sense wasn't entirely shot, it was still daylight somewhere above us. Bella and Arabella had to be on the far side of the world of which Empis was a part. But here, those two moons were just the same, projected out of a black void that had no business existing, washing this hellhole in their pallid and eldritch light. The larger was closing in on the smaller, and it wasn't going to pass behind or in front. After the high gods only knew how many thousands of years, the two moons, these and the real ones somewhere around the curve of the planet, were on a collision course. They came together in a crash that was soundless. It really was a projection, then, and accompanied by a brilliant flash of light. Pieces flew in every direction, filling that dark sky like smashed chunks of glowing crockery. That toneless bray grew even louder, deafening. The boom of the derrick began to rise, narrowing the triangle between it and the supporting mast. There was no sound of machinery, but I wouldn't have heard it anyway. The fierce glare of the disintegrating moons blotted out the stars and bathed the floor below in brilliance. The hatch over the dark well began to rise, pulled by the derrick's hook. The grotesque creature in the purple robe was also looking up, and when Leah looked down, their eyes met. His were deep in sagging sockets of greenish flesh. Hers were wide and blue. In spite of all the years and all the changes, she recognized him. Her dismay and horror were unmistakable. I tried to hold her back, but she pulled free with a convulsive jerk that almost sent her over the edge. And I was in shock, numbed by what I had seen. The collision of two moons in a sky that had no right to exist. The pieces were spreading and starting to dim. A crescent of darkness appeared at the edge of the dark well hatch and quickly widened into a black grin. That long, hoarse cry of satisfaction grew louder. The flight killer stumbled toward the well. His purple robe rose in several different directions. For a moment, that horrible, flabby head was obscured, and then the robe fell to one side and lay on the stone floor. The man beneath it was only half a man, as Elsa had only been half a woman. His legs had been replaced by a gnarl of black tentacles that hurried him along, teetering from side to side. Others protruded from the hanging sack of his belly, rising toward the rising hatch like obscene erections. His arms had been replaced by snake-like horrors that wavered around his face like seaweed in a strong current, and I realized that whatever the thing in the well might be, it wasn't Cthulhu. Eldin was this world's Cthulhu, as surely as Dora was the old woman who lived in a shoe, and Leah was the goose girl. He had traded deformed feet and a hunched back, kyphosis, for something far worse. Did he consider the trade fair? Had revenge and the slow destruction of the kingdom been enough to balance the scales? Leah reached the bottom of the stairs. Overhead, the fragments of Bella and Arabella continued to expand.
Leah!
I shouted.
Leah, for God's sake, stop!
Just past the palanquin with its limply hanging drapes, she did stop, but not because I'd called to her. I don't think she even heard me. All her attention was fixed on the flabby thing that had been her brother. Now he was bending eagerly over the rising hatch, the loose flesh of his face hanging down like dough. The crown fell off his head again. More of those black tentacles emerged from his neck, his back, and the cleft of his buttocks. He was turning into Cthulhu before my eyes, Lord of the Old Gods, a nightmare fairy tale come to life. But the real monster was below. Soon it would emerge. Gog Magog. 8. I remember what happened next with heartbreaking clarity. I saw it all from where I was standing, maybe a dozen steps above the abandoned palanquin, and still see it in my dreams. Radar was barking, but I could barely hear her over the constant maddening drone from the dark well. Leah raised her dagger and with no hesitation plunged it deep into the feeding sore beside what had been her mouth. Then, using both hands, she raked it across the scar, right to left.
Eldin!
She screamed. Blood flew from her reopened mouth in a fine spray. Her voice was hoarse, from her feats of ventriloquism, I supposed, but the first word she'd spoken without having to project it from deep in her throat was loud enough for her wretched brother to hear, even over the hum. He turned. He saw her. Really saw her, for the first time.
Eldin, stop! While there's still time!
He hesitated. That forest of tentacles, more of them now, many more, waving. Did I see love in those bleary eyes? Regret? Sorrow, maybe shame that he'd cursed the only one who had loved him along with all those who had not? Or only the need to preserve what was slipping away after a reign that had been all too short? But doesn't it seem that way to all of us when the end comes? I didn't know. I was running down the last steps, past the palanquin. I had no plan in mind, just a need to get her away before the thing down there could emerge. I thought of the giant cockroach that had escaped into Mr. Bowditch's shed and how Mr. Bowditch had shot it, and that reminded me finally that I still had his gun. Leah walked into that waving glut of tentacles, seemingly unaware of the danger they posed. One of them caressed her cheek. Eldin was still looking at her, and was he crying?
Go back,
he croaked.
Go back, while you can. I can't.
One of those tentacles wrapped around her blood-streaked neck. It was clear what he couldn't do, stop the part of him that had been possessed by the thing below. All those books he'd read in the palace library, had none contained the most basic story of all cultures? The one that says when you deal with the devil, you make a devil's bargain? I grabbed the tentacle, one that might have been part of an arm when Eldin first made his bargain, and yanked it free of her throat. It was tough and coated with some kind of slime. Once it was no longer choking Leah, I let it slither out of my grip. Another wrapped around my wrist, a second one around my thigh. They began to pull me toward Eldin and the opening well. I raised Mr. Bowditch's gun to shoot him. Before I could, a tentacle curled around the barrel, jerked it away, and sent it spinning across the rough stone floor in the direction of the abandoned palanquin. Radar was now standing between Eldin and the well, all her hackles up, barking so hard that foam flew from her jaws. She lunged to bite him. A tentacle, one that had been part of Eldon's left leg, snapped out like a whip and sent her sprawling. I was being dragged forward. The monster might have been weeping for his sister, but it was also grinning in anticipation of some awful victory, real or imagined. Two more tentacles, small ones, emerged from that grin to taste the air. The derrick was still pulling the hatch, but something else, something beneath, was pushing it as well, widening the gap. Another world down there, I thought. A black one I never want to see.
You were all part of it,
the flabby green-faced creature shrieked at Leah.
You were all part of it, or you would have come with me. You would have been my queen.
More of Flightkiller's tentacles seized her, legs, waist, once more around the neck, and dragged her forward. Something was coming out of the well. An oily black substance stippled with long white thorns. It hit the floor with a wet slap. It was a wing.
I am the queen, Leah cried. You aren't my brother. He was kind. You're an assassin and a pretender. You are an imposter.
She plunged the dagger, still dripping with her blood, into her brother's eye. The tentacles fell away from her. He staggered back. The wing rose and gave a flap that sent a nauseating gust of air into my face. It wrapped around Eldon. The thorns impaled him. He was dragged to the lip of the well. He gave a final shriek before the thing plunged its hooked thorns into his chest and dragged him in. But having its puppet wasn't enough to satisfy it. A bubble of alien flesh rose from the well. Huge golden eyes stared at us from what was otherwise no face at all. There was a scraping, grinding sound, and a second thorn-covered wing emerged. It gave an exploratory flap, and another gust of putrescent air struck me.
Go back!
Leah shouted. Blood sprayed from her ragged, liberated mouth. Droplets struck the emerging thing and sizzled.
I, the Queen of Empus, command you!
It continued to emerge, now flapping both of its thorny wings. Strings of some noisome fluid sprayed from it. The light from the shattered moons had continued to fade, and I could barely see the humped, twisted thing that was rising, its sides bulging in and out like a bellows. Eldon's head was disappearing into its strange flesh. His dead face, stamped with his final expression of horror, looked out at us like the face of a man disappearing into quicksand. Radar's barks were now more like screams. I think it might have been some kind of dragon, but not of the sort seen in any book of fairy tales. It was from beyond my world. Leah's, too. The dark well opened into some other universe beyond all human comprehension. And Leah's command did nothing to stop it. It came out. It came out. The moons had kissed, and soon it would be free. 9. Leah didn't command it again. She must have decided it was useless. She only craned her neck to watch that thing as it grew from the well. Now there was only Radar, barking and barking, but somehow, miraculously, heroically, holding her ground. I realized that I was going to die, and it would be a mercy, assuming, that was, life didn't continue in some terrible, hellish drone. Once I and Leah and Radar were taken into the thing's alien being. I had read that at such moments one's whole life flashes before one's eyes. What flashed before me, like illustrations in a book whose pages are quickly fanned, were all the fairy tales I had encountered in Empus, from the Shoe Woman and the Goose Girl, to the houses of the three little exiles, to the mean sisters who never would have taken their beautiful little sister or deformed little brother to the ball. It was growing, growing, thorny wings flapping. Eldin's face had disappeared into its unknowable guts. Then I thought of another fairy tale. Once upon a time, there had been a mean little man named Christopher Polly, who had come to steal Mr. Bowditch's gold. Once upon a time, there had been a mean little man named Peterkin, who had been torturing the snab with a dagger. Once upon a time, my mother was struck by a plumber's truck on the Sycamore Street Bridge and killed when it drove her into one of the bridge stanchions. Most of her stayed on the bridge, but her head and shoulders had gone into the Little Rumple River. Always Rumpelstiltskin, from the very beginning. The original fairy tale, you might say. And how did the queen's daughter get rid of that troublesome elf?
"I know your name!"
I shouted. The voice was not my own, no more than many of the thoughts and insights in this story belong to the 17-year-old boy who first came to Empus. It was the voice of a prince. Not of this world, and not of mine. I had begun by calling Empus the other, but I was the other. Still Charlie Reed, sure, but I was someone else as well. And the idea that I had been sent here, that my clock had been wound and set years ago when my mother walked across that bridge munching a chicken wing, for just this moment was impossible to doubt. Later, when the person I was in that underground world began to ebb away, I would doubt it, but then, no.
"I know your name, Gog Magog, and I command you to return to your lair!"
It screamed. The stone floor shook and cracks ran across it. Far above us, graves were once more giving up their dead, and a great crevasse was zigzagging its way across the field of the monarchs. Those huge wings flapped, raining down stinking drops that burned like acid. But you know what? I liked that scream because I was a dark prince, and that was a scream of pain.
"Gog Magog! Gog Magog! Your name is Gog Magog!"
It screamed each time I spoke its name. Those screams were in the world. They were also deep in my head, as the hum had been, threatening to burst my skull. The wings beat frantically. Great eyes glared at me.
"Return to your lair, Gog Magog! You may come again, Gog Magog, in 10 years or 1,000, Gog Magog! But not this day, Gog Magog!"
I spread my arms.
"If you take me in, Gog Magog, I'll burst your guts with your name before I die!"
It began to retreat, folding its wings over those hideous staring eyes. The sound of its descent was a liquid shloop that made me want to vomit. I wondered how the hell we were supposed to make that gigantic derrick lower the lid, but Leah had that one. Her voice was hoarse and broken, but couldn't I see lips emerging from the mangled wreck of her mouth? I'm not sure, but having been force-fed so much make-believe, I gladly swallowed that one.
"Close in the name of Leah of the Galleon!"
Slowly, far too slowly for my taste, the derrick's boom began to lower the hatch. The tautness came out of the cable, and at last the hook swung free. I let out my breath. Leah threw herself into my arms, hugging for all she was worth. The blood from her newly opened mouth was warm on my neck. Something thudded into me from behind. It was Radar. Rear paws on the floor, front ones propped on my ass, tail wagging like mad.
"How did you know?"
Leah asked in her broken voice. A story my mother told me, I said. Which was, in a way, true. She had told me now by dying then.
We have to go, Leah, or we're going to have to find our way in the dark. And you need to stop talking. I can see how much it hurts.
Yes, but the hurt is wonderful.
Leah pointed to the palanquin.
They must have brought at least one lantern. Do you still have matches?
For a wonder, I did. We walked hand in hand to the abandoned palanquin, radar between us. Leah bent down once along the way, but I hardly noticed. I was concentrating on getting something to light our way before the light from the shattered moons faded entirely. I brushed back one of the palanquin's curtains, and there, cringing against its far side, was the one member of Eldon's party I'd forgotten about.
Flight killer, Percival had said, four others, and the bitch. Or maybe he'd said the witch.
Petra's hair had come loose from the crisscross strings of pearls that had bound it. Her white makeup had cracked and run. She stared at me with horror and loathing.
You ruined everything, you hateful brat.
Brat made me smile.
Nah, nah, sweetheart. Sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me.
Hanging from a little brass hook at the front of the palanquin was just what I was hoping for. One of those torpedo-shaped lanterns.
I was his consort, do you hear? His chosen one. I let him touch me with those loathsome snakes that used to be his arms. I licked his drool. He didn't have long to live. Any fool could see that, and I would have ruled.
Not worthy of a response, in my humble opinion.
I would have been Queen of Empis.
I reached for the lantern. Her lips peeled back from teeth that had been filed to points like Hannah's. Perhaps that had been the coming fashion in the flight killer's hellish court. She lunged forward and buried those fangs in my arm. The pain was immediate and excruciating. Blood seeped out from her clamped lips. Her eyes bulged from their sockets. I tried to pull free. My flesh tore, but her teeth stayed clamped.
Petra,
Leah said. Her voice was down to a hoarse growl.
Have this, you stinking crone.
The roar of Mr. Bowditch's 45, which Leah had stooped to pick up, was deafening. A hole appeared in the caked white makeup just above Petra's right eye. Her head fell back, and before she crashed to the floor of the palanquin, I saw something I could have done without. A doorknob-sized gobbet of my forearm hanging from those filed teeth. Leah didn't hesitate. She tore down one of the palanquin's hanging side drapes, ripped a long piece from the bottom, and tied it around the wound. Now it was almost completely dark. I reached into the gloom with my good arm to get the lantern. The idea that Petra might come to life and batten on that one too was ridiculous but strong. I almost dropped it. Prince or no prince, I was shaking with shock. My arm felt as if Petra hadn't just bitten it, but poured gasoline into the wound and set it on fire.
You light it,
I said.
The matches are in the holster.
I felt her fumble at my hip, then heard her scratch one of the sulfur matches on the side of the palanquin. I tipped back the lantern's glass chimney. She turned a little knob on the side to advance the wick and lit it. Then she took it from me, which was good, I would have dropped it. I started for the spiral staircase. I thought I'd be happy never to see another one of those. But she held me back and pulled me down. I felt her tattered mouth move against my ear as she whispered,
"She was my great aunt."
She was far too young to be your great anything, I thought. Then I remembered Mr. Bowditch, who had gone on a trip and come back as his own son.
Let's get out of here and never come back, I said.
10. We climbed out of the pit very slowly. I had to stop and rest every 50 steps or so. My arm was throbbing with each beat of my heart, and I could feel the makeshift bandage Leah had put on soaking with blood. I kept seeing Petra as she fell back dead with a chunk of my flesh in her mouth. When we got to the top of the steps, I had to sit down. My head was throbbing now, as well as my arm. I remembered reading somewhere that when it comes to starting a dangerous, perhaps even lethal, infection, nothing but the bite of a rabid animal beats one from a supposedly healthy human. And how was I to know how healthy Petra had been after years of commerce? My mind balked at the idea of actual congress with Eldon. I imagined I could feel her poison coursing up my arm to the shoulder and from there to my heart. Telling myself I was full of shit didn't help much. Leah gave me a few moments to sit with radar anxiously nuzzling the side of my face, then pointed to the reservoir of the lantern. It was almost empty, and the glow from the walls had gone with the death of Eldon and the retreat of Gogmagog. Her point was clear. If we didn't want to have to stumble our way out in the dark, we had to move. We were about halfway up the steep incline leading to the huge chamber with its ring of 12 passages when the lantern guttered and went out. Leah sighed, then gripped my good hand. We walked slowly on. The dark was unpleasant, but with the hum and the whispering voices gone, it wasn't so bad. The pain in my arm was. The bite hadn't clotted. I could feel warm blood in my palm and between my fingers. Radar sniffed it and whined. I thought of Iota dying from the nick of a poisoned knife. Like the memory of my flesh hanging from Petra's pointed teeth, it wasn't anything I wanted to think about, but was helpless not to. Leah stopped and pointed. I realized I could see her point because now there was light in the passage again. Not the sick green light from those strange half-glass, half-stone walls, but a warm yellow glow, waxing and waning. As it brightened, Radar ran toward it, barking her head off.
No!
I shouted. That made my headache worse.
Stay, girl!
She paid no attention, and those weren't the furious, terrified barks she'd voiced in the dark universe we'd left behind. But not far enough. It would never be far enough. These were excited barks, and something was coming out of the growing glow, jumping out of it. Radar went flat, tail and rump wagging, and the snab leaped onto her back. Following it was a swarm of fireflies. The Lord of Small Things, I said. I'll be damned. The fireflies, there had to have been at least 1,000, formed an incandescent cloud over my dog and the big red cricket on her back. And the two of them were beautiful in their low and shifting light. Radar rose, I think at some command from her rider that wasn't meant for human ears. She started up the inclined floor. The fireflies headed back that way, swirling over them. Leah squeezed my hand. We followed the fireflies. 11. Eris was waiting in the cathedral-sized room with the 12 passages. The snab had brought a battalion of fireflies to us, but had left a platoon to keep Eris from being in total darkness. When we emerged, she ran to me and hugged me. When I stiffened in pain, she drew back and looked at the makeshift bandage, soaked with blood and still dripping.
"My gods, what happened to you?"
Then she looked at Leah and gasped.
"Oh, my lady."
Too much to tell, thinking it might be too much to tell ever. "Why are you here? Why did you come back?"
"The snab led me and brought light, as you see. You need medical attention, both of you, and Freed is far too ill."
It will have to be Claudia then, I thought. Claudia will know what to do, if anything can be done. "We need to get out of here," I said. "I'm so sick of being underground." I looked at the red cricket on Radar's back. It looked back at me, those small black eyes giving it a singularly solemn aspect. "Lead on, Sir Snab, if you would be so kind." And so it did. 12. Several people were crowded into the clothes storage room when we finally came out. The fireflies streamed away over their heads in a banner of light. Jaya was there, and Percival, and several others from my time of incarceration in Deep Malene, but I don't remember which ones. By then, I was growing increasingly woozy, and my headache was so bad that it seemed to have materialized into a pulsing white ball of pain, hanging about 3 inches in front of my eyes. The only two things I remember clearly are that the snab was no longer on Radar's back, and Percival looked better. It was impossible to say how, given that white ball of pain in front of me and the bone-deep throb in my torn arm, but he did. I was sure of it. Our greeters knelt at the side of the princess and raised their hands to their lowered brows.
"Up," she croaked.
Her voice was almost gone, but I thought that was from overuse and would come back in time. The idea that her vocal cords had been permanently ruptured was too horrible even to consider. They rose. With Leah supporting me on one side and Eris on the other, we left the overcrowded storage room. I made it most of the way to the first staircase, then my legs gave out. I was carried, maybe by my friends from Deep Malene, maybe by Grey Folk, maybe both, I can't remember. I do remember being carried through the reception hall and seeing at least 3 dozen gray-faced men and women cleaning the mess that had been left there by those of King Jan's court who had elected to give their allegiance to the Flight Killer. It seemed to me that one of the cleaners was Dora, wearing a red cloth wrapped around her hair and her splendidly yellow canvas shoes on her feet. She raised her hands to her mouth and blew me a kiss, with fingers that were beginning to look like fingers again, rather than flippers. "She isn't there," I thought. "You're delirious, Prince Charlie. And even if she is, her fingers can't be regenerating. Stuff like that only happens in..." "In what?" "Well, in stories like this." I craned my neck for another look at her as I was carried out into the next room, some kind of antechamber, and saw the bright head rag and the brighter sneakers, but I couldn't be sure it was Dora. She was back to me and on her knees, scrubbing away filth. We passed through more rooms and down a long hallway, but by then I was fading toward unconsciousness and would be glad to go if it took me to a place where my head didn't feel like it was bursting and my arm didn't feel like a blazing Yule log. But I held on. If I was dying, and it certainly felt like I was, I wanted to do it outside, breathing free air. Bright light struck me. It made my head ache worse, but it was still wonderful, because it wasn't the sick light of the underground world beneath Lillimar. It wasn't even the far friendlier glow of the fireflies. This was daylight, but it was more. It was sunlight. I was carried into it, half sitting, half lying down. The clouds were unraveling and I could see blue sky above the great plaza in front of the palace. Not just enough blue to make a pair of overalls, but acres of blue, no, miles of it. And my God, what sunshine! I looked down and saw my shadow. Seeing it made me feel like Peter Pan, that prince of the lost boys. A vast cheer went up. The city gate was open, and the plaza was filled with the gray folk of Empus. They saw Leah and went to their knees with a great rustle that gave me goose flesh. She was looking at me. I think that look said, "I could use a little help here." "Put me down," I said. My bearers did, and I found I could stand. All the pain was still there, but something else was there as well. It had been there when I cried Gog Magog's name in a voice that wasn't my own, and it was here now. I raised my arms, the good right and the left that was still dripping blood, turning to scarlet the new bandage Jaya had at some point put on, like the poppies on the hill behind Dora's trim little house. The people below were silent, waiting on their knees. And in spite of the power I felt rushing through me just then, I remembered they were not kneeling for me. This wasn't my world. My world was the other. but I had one more job to do here.
Listen to me, people of Empus. The Flight Killer is dead.
They roared approval and thanks.
The Dark Well is shut, and the creature that lives there is pent inside.
Another roar greeted this. Now I felt that power, that otherness, leaving me, taking the strength I had borrowed with it. Soon I'd be plain old Charlie Reed again. If Petra's bite didn't kill me, that was.
Hail Leah, people of Empus! Hail Leah of the Galleon! Hail your queen!
I think it was a boffo line to go out on, as my dad might have said. But I'll never know for sure, because that's when the hinges fell out of my knees and I lost consciousness.